I'm Tess Vigeland. Credit card companies are changing the rules overnight, lowering limits, jacking up rates. Why do they get away with it? Because we let them.
Most people won't push back. Even if they have good credit, they won't realize that they have an alternative.
Yes, Virginia, there is an alternative. And where some investors see red lights, others see green, and lots of it.
WaMu, Lehman Brothers, and IndyMac are just calling like sirens to me.
Glass half full or half full of crazy? Speaking of which, how would you describe a person who can point you to every sale, every coupon, every bargain on earth?
My mom's not crazy. She's a sociological phenomenon studied by economists.
And I definitely want her at my side when I hit the mall. That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Cupcakes? Check. Candles? Check. Party hats? Check. Black cloud of economic doom? Check. It's your first birthday recession, and trust me, it's not exactly happy. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
So we in the media can stop asking that fairly ridiculous question about, you know, are we in an official recession? Yes, we are, duh. And have been since last December, according to the pointy heads who track such things. So then it's no surprise that the latest unemployment figures show more than 500,000 jobs dropped off payrolls in November, the biggest loss since the mid-70s. And believe it or not, that's only a small part of the story. The government also puts out underemployment stats, and that figure is almost double the number of people who are unemployed. But what exactly does it mean to be underemployed? We asked Rachel Dornhelm to find out.
Let's start with the easy part, official definitions. The unemployment number counts anyone who is actively looking for work.
Now, there's a lot of people who have given up looking for work. There's people who are working, but not as many hours as they'd like. Those people are counted in the underemployment rate.
That's Jared Bernstein from the Economic Policy Institute. He says of the two concepts, underemployment gets less attention, but it's a bigger problem.
It has gone up considerably faster than unemployment. And that's partially because when this recession got started, employers didn't necessarily lay people off as much as they cut their hours.
He says that's what has so many families feeling so pinched right now. Wage earners who don't have enough hours or are no longer applying for jobs. But Bernstein says that's only part of the story.
Then there's this other group of unknown size who is working below their potential.
This is where the concept of underemployment gets fuzzy. There are a lot of people who are excluded from the official number. They're almost impossible to track, but they're not hard to find. Just ask Catherine Levinson.
I have a BA from UC Santa Barbara in anthropology, and then an MA from Harvard, plus about another 6 years of PhD work.
In February, she left a job as a school teacher in Berkeley, California, after she was injured breaking up a fight between two students. Since then, she's been living off savings, working part-time in retail, and applying for countless jobs. Just recently, she started selling insurance on commission.
Is it where you imagined you'd be after getting all that education?
Totally not.
Another unofficial definition of underemployment would include people who have full-time jobs with benefits, but still can't make ends meet.
My name is Dennis Elston. I'm working at near minimum wage.
Elston is 54 and lives in Flint, Michigan. He drives 84 miles round trip to his full-time job every day. He says the other month, his boss gathered the department around a table.
And was talking about what if we lost our job or we're going on to part-time instead of full-time work. And if we could survive on just 40% of our pay, and at that point I had already realized that I wasn't surviving on 100% of what I was working for.
Elston says he got through last year thanks to an extra $1,000 from a home equity loan for roof repairs and help from his parents. Then there are those left out of the official underemployment figures because they're working for themselves, like Jeff Winker. He was laid off from his PR job in Seattle 2 months ago and is now self-employed, getting small jobs here and there. And that's on top of his other responsibilities.
If you're underemployed and you're looking for full-time employment, you are always working. You're working to find a job. You're working to take care of the kids.
Winker says as time goes on, he's willing to take any full-time job just to get the benefits. But until he lands that opportunity, he's trying to look on the bright side of underemployment and indulge his creative dreams. He says he's sleeping just 4.5 hours a night so he can write a series of blogs and a screenplay. I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
For a lot of Americans, being underemployed is just one of many financial setbacks. Another is the credit card bill that keeps arriving in the mail. Not just the balance on it, but the new strings attached to it. Higher fees, higher interest rates, lower credit lines. All this at a time when consumers need that cushion and the economy needs them to spend. Credit expert Liz Pulliam-Weston is here with us, and I have to ask, why are card companies doing this?
Banks need money, and they're worried about risk. So they're trying to reduce their risk by raising interest rates, lowering rates on people they think are the greatest risks, and also doing the same for people they think won't push back. And the reality is most people won't push back. Even if they have good credit, they won't realize that they have an alternative. What they don't realize is if they have good credit scores, they don't have to live with it. They can push back. They can take their business elsewhere.
Is that the easiest way to do it? Just say, okay, bye-bye.
Well, it's easiest to abandon them, yes, but you should at least try to push back. So if you have good credit, you want to gather some of the offers that you're probably still getting in the mail or go to creditcards.com, bankrate.com, see some of the competing offers. Call your credit card company and say, hey, look, I've got great credit or good credit, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. I can take any one of these offers. If they don't give you what you want, then you threaten to close the account. You don't want to actually do that because that can hurt your credit report, your credit scores, but you threaten to do that.
Let's talk about this notion of closing your accounts. We've had many people write in who have heard from Chase, from Citibank. What these folks are wondering is, you know, that one of the outs is that you can write back to the credit card company and say, I decline the new terms of my credit card. They basically freeze you where you're at. You have to pay off the credit card and then they close your account. What are the downsides? What are the upsides to going ahead and closing an account?
Well, the obvious upside to closing that account is that you can typically preserve the rate and terms that you had. The downside is that closing an account cannot help your credit score, and it may hurt it.
But if you're not planning to buy a home anytime in the near future or a car, should you be worried about your credit score?
Your credit score is actually involved in a lot more decisions than just whether you get credit and how much it costs, although it's key to that. In many states, insurers can use it to determine the premiums that you pay. Also, having good credit can be important for getting an apartment and for jobs. A lot of employers want to look at your credit report to see how well you're doing. Now, the credit limit issue and how many open accounts is going to matter much less to an employer than it might to a landlord or to a credit card company or other lender that's looking just at your score.
We've mentioned the drop in limits and higher interest rates. The other thing we've been hearing from listeners is that their minimum payment amount has been hiked. It's no longer, say, 2% or 3%. It's going up to 5%, where you are required to pay more on that credit card. I wonder if that's a good thing.
We're really going back to the old school. That was the way it was in the 70s. If you have a credit card, your minimum payment was at least 5% and could be higher. That ensured that you were paying down the principal that you owed. And here's the problem we have. A lot of people that have been paying just the minimums are already stretched to their absolute limits. So I would say if you're in a position where you're struggling to pay your minimums now, now is the time to talk to a legitimate credit counselor, because really, if you can't afford those minimums, you're in pretty deep trouble.
Liz Pulliam Weston is a personal finance columnist for MSN, a good friend of the show here. Also the author of Your Credit Score, coming out to third edition.
Third edition, probably in February. That's what it looks like now.
Terrific. Well, thanks again for coming in.
Thank you, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story, and our very own economics editor, Chris Farrell, is with us once again. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So we've just been talking to Liz Weston about some of these new credit card issues, shall we say, that are popping up with people getting their interest rates jacked up and minimum payments jacked up and limits lowered. What's your take on all this? Would you recommend that people close accounts?
Well, I agree with Liz. You don't want your credit score to be determining your financial life. You want your financial life to end up determining your credit score. So here's what I mean by that. If it makes financial sense for you to close an account, do the smart thing for you. Because in the end, if you're responsible with your debt, you're going to have a good credit score. But more importantly, you're going to be in control of your financial life. And I applaud that. And that's the right move to make.
I want to ask you about some moves that were made this week in the UK to help credit card consumers. Tell us a little bit about what they've done over there. It sounds like essentially 60 days worth of a break for people who are having trouble.
Yeah. So you're a troubled borrower and you have your credit card debt. What the banks are now going to give you, the credit card issuers are now going to give you, is 60 days to sort of, you know, pull things together. You work with a nonprofit agency that will help you restructure your debts or come up with a payment schedule. So as long as you're working with this nonprofit agency, in other words, you're showing a good faith effort, they're not going to hike your interest rate. They're not going to jack up your fees. They're going to give you breathing room. Now, they didn't do this out of the goodness of their heart.
Really?
No. The British government's taken a big stake. Big stake in these banks. And basically they said, look, it doesn't make any sense for you to drive people who are at the edge, the financial edge, over the edge. We're all in this together.
Well, and you mentioned that in the UK, basically the government has made moves to help the banks in this time of trouble, which is exactly what's happened here. All these banks are taking taxpayer money as part of the bailout, and yet they're then turning around and, I mean, there are a lot of taxpayers who are credit card holders and they're slamming those credit card holders.
Absolutely. Now, if we're in a normal environment and a bank, a credit card issuer wants to behave this way, I think it's a little bit crazy, but that's what they want to do. Fine. But we're not in a normal economic environment. They can't drive more and more consumers into bankruptcy, more and more consumers into foreclosure. In fact, I would argue moratorium. You can't raise their interest rate. You can't raise their fee. You want to do that? Buy out the taxpayer. Then you can do what you want. But as long as the U.S. taxpayer is an owner, you can't do it.
All right. Well, maybe we should all just cut up our credit cards and never use them again. Maybe I'll think about that as a New Year's resolution for next year. No credit cards. Oh, geez. I don't think I want to do that. All right. Talk to you later in the show. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
Who doesn't love a bargain, especially when you don't have to risk life and limb shopping for one?
Anytime I can buy the dynamism of the American economy, American business, at a 40% discount, I'm interested.
There's a blue light special in the S&P 500 aisle. It's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. You think you've lost a lot of investment money in this downturn? Try $8 billion. That's what leaked out of Harvard's endowment over the last 4 months. But you know what? That's only a 22% drop. Not bad, given that many of us are looking at losses of 30, 40, even 50%. Maybe we should fire our mutual fund managers. Well, Dan Culliton is an analyst with Morningstar. Let me ask you, how do you know if it's your fund manager's fault?
We try to focus on what we call the five P's. People, who's running my fund? Process, how are they investing my money? Price, what are the fees that this fund is charging me? Portfolio, what is in this fund? What does this fund own? And how will it behave in certain markets? And then parent, what is the culture of this fund company? Is it a shareholder-friendly fund company? Does it really believe it is a steward of shareholder capital, or is it really just out to gather fee-generating assets and to feather its own bed?
How do you take those five P's and do that research yourself?
A simple way is to ask yourself, is this mutual fund doing what I hired it to do in the first place? Is the same manager who I was attracted to in the first place still running this fund? There have been a number of cases where mutual funds not only have posted dramatic losses this year, but they've also switched managers and they've changed strategies in midstream too. And that's always a big warning flag, because then not only are you left with a fund that's performing poorly, but you're left with something you didn't intend to buy in the first place. You're left with a different manager, a different strategy, and probably different returns going forward.
How do you know who the manager is and whether that manager has been changed in midstream in your fund? Is it right at the top somewhere it says this fund is managed by, you know, Bill Miller, for example, at Legg Mason?
Not always, unfortunately. Unfortunately, mutual fund disclosure varies from fund to fund and from family to family. And there are some families which make the manager's name front and center, make it very easy to find in the prospectus and on the website. Other funds, it's a lot harder. The prospectus documents are much more legalistic and complicated and hard to slog through.
You know, I mentioned one of the more famous names in mutual fund management, Bill Miller over at Legg Mason, who had a long, long, long track record of really outstanding returns, but has not had a really great last couple of years. What kind of track record should you be looking for? I mean, does 2 years a bad manager make, or should you be looking at, you know, 10, 15, 20 years?
I think it's fair to judge a mutual fund manager by the holding period, by the manager's own holding period. So if you get a manager, say like Dodge & Cox, Dodge & Cox stock, where they hold everything they buy for 3 to 5 years, it's hard to assess the quality of that fund and the quality of their decisions in anything less than 3 to 5 years, and even longer. So you have to know the strategy, and you have to see if the performance lines up with what you would expect.
You know, the mutual fund is basically saying, yeah, we're keeping on track, we're following our strategy, but do you really know that behind the scenes that's actually what they're doing?
You could take a look at what they own and see whether it jibes with what they claim to be doing with your money. If a manager claims that they're going to be fully invested at all times, and all of a sudden they put half of the fund in treasury bills, you have to ask, what's going on here? Why aren't you sticking to your strategy? Why aren't you staying fully invested like you said you would?
Dan Culleton is a senior mutual fund analyst at Morningstar. Thanks so much for helping us out today.
Thank you, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
When volatility is the new normal on Wall Street, down 700 points one day, up 500 the next, the first instinct might be to take your money and run. In this edition of What Are You Doing?, we hear the optimist's approach.
My name is John Lane. I live in Vancouver, Washington. I've been kind of dabbling in the stock market. I've never done it before. It's been pretty exciting. I started about a month and a half ago, started buying up what other people would consider crazy stocks, but I'm having a blast and doing okay at it. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG, these are fundamentally sound companies with flawed business strategies. I think they're going to be solvent again. WaMu, Lehman Brothers, and IndyMac are just calling like sirens to me. If you went out and bought 5,000 shares of WaMu, it would cost you $200. If it hit a five-year high, that's $229,000. I've spent $943 you know, it's not a lot of money, but I own 625 shares of blue chip stock. Blue chips that have turned into cow chips recently. This is probably not good advice to normal people. You know, it's a gamble. I mean, my wife's calling them a lottery ticket, but it seems like a pretty good gamble to me.
John Lane in Vancouver, Washington. And you can find all the voices from our series, Here's What I'm Doing, at marketplace.org. And now we'd like to bring in a professional investor. He's been in the business for years, very familiar name to anyone in personal finance, Knight Kiplinger, editor-in-chief of Kiplinger's Magazine. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tess.
You've just heard our Here's What I'm Doing, and I wonder, are IndyMac, WaMu, Fannie Mae, any of those calling to you?
No, they're not calling to me. They called to me a few years ago, and I actually own shares. But they don't call to me now because I'm not a stock speculator. And the gentleman we just heard is going to have a lot of fun. And if he's having fun with a small amount of his money, that's good. But he didn't describe an investment plan. And I'm all about creating a long-term investment plan, a game plan, and sticking to it, which means you keep buying through slumps like this.
Well, let's talk about your recent column for your magazine, which is titled, Why I Am Buying Stocks. This is not something that a lot of people are doing. In fact, they are dumping all over the place. Why are you buying stocks?
First of all, the title is Why I'm Buying Stocks Now, but we could have left off the word now. And the more important point is, why have I continued to buy stocks every month throughout this dismal bear market? And the reason is, anytime I can buy the dynamism of the American economy, American business, at a 40% discount, I'm interested. It's the same reason that people hit the stores at 6 a.m. on the Friday after Thanksgiving to buy great merchandise at 50% off. I'm bargain shopping. Does that mean that prices might not go lower? Yes, they might. But if you buy on the fear and the panic of others who are dumping quality stocks, if you can buy these at a significant discount from a year ago, why wouldn't you want to?
Well, how exactly are you doing that? How are you judging what is a buying day when the economy is essentially, especially the stock market, is on what a pogo stick of sorts? One day it's way down, one day it's way up. How are you making the decision when exactly to buy?
In my 401k, I max out every month, and that money is deployed in the same mix of assets that it was 2 years ago, stocks, bonds. So I am averaging down my cost basis in good stocks that I already owned and buying some that I didn't previously own. I could focus entirely on the so-called consumer staples, the companies that make things that people continue to buy in good times or bad, household products, personal hygiene, things like that. But instead, I'm using total market index funds. I'm buying a sliver of over 3,000 publicly traded companies in America because I don't know which sector is going to have its day in the sunshine and its day in the doghouse. So I want to own a piece of all of those. And so far in this dismal fall, the stocks I bought after these big drops are ahead. And this is what you have to do. The foundations of future fortunes are made in bear markets.
But when we talk about taking, I mean, anytime you buy into the market, you're taking some sort of risk. How much of this advice is based on when you're going to need to take the money out?
That's a great question, Tess. I've always said that any money for which you have a foreseeable known need in the next 3 to 5 years should never be in stocks in the first place. I love the asset allocation advice of John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard Investments. John Bogle says that your percentage of bonds should equal your age. So a 60-year-old investor should be 60% in bonds at all times and only 40% in equities. Conversely, the 30-year-old can be 70% in equities because he has a longer time horizon to let the dynamism of the American economy make money for him or her.
When you look out at that horizon, I think the question that a lot of people are flummoxed by is, when is this finally going to recover? Now, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but Is there any way to look at, say, average recoveries from recessions, from stock market declines, and say you should begin to see some benefit to buying into this down market at X point?
Yes. Traditionally, stock markets begin to move upwards while a recession is still officially underway. I would expect that this recession is going to look pretty bad through most of 2009, but sometime in the middle of 2009 or in the fall of 2009, investors are going to say, I think the worst is behind us, and you're going to see a lot of serious money moving back into the market.
Well, you've made me feel much better than I have in probably the last 2 or 3 months, Knight.
Well, if you're patient about this, and remember, I'm not giving market timing advice here to run out and load up for a 6 month gain. I'm just buying on the fears of others. I'm buying the broad U.S. economy. These are good companies that are going to come back strong. But in the meantime, the dividend helps you bide your time.
Well, thanks for bringing us at least a little bit of a ray of sunshine.
You're very welcome, Tess.
Knight Kiplinger is the editor-in-chief of Kiplinger's Magazine and the Kiplinger Letter and Kiplinger.com. His column, Why I'm Buying Stocks Now, is in the current issue of Kiplinger's Magazine. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we dig through our voicemail and our email to answer your questions. And with me once again is our own Chris Farrell. Chris, you survived Thanksgiving okay? Do much Black Friday buying?
Oh, I had a wonderful Thanksgiving. And no, I did not do any Black Friday shopping.
Ah, a little frugality on your part then.
Oh, yeah. I practice frugality. Yes, absolutely. And also, I can't deal with the crowds.
Amen to that.
Let's be honest here. I just can't deal with the crowds.
Well, of course, that means your credit card probably stayed in your wallet. But, Chris, our first question today is what is really an ongoing and consistent problem that some people have with their credit cards. Kaya wrote in from Boston, Massachusetts, and she recently realized that her card does not report her credit limit. And she's wondering how that might affect her credit score. This is not a good thing for the customer, right?
Basically, it's not a good thing for the customer. There are two reasons why the credit limit might not be reported. One is just some credit card companies don't do it. They don't want to do it. They consider it proprietary information. And frankly, I think that's outrageous. There's another set of cards, American Express, and then there have been a number of bank cards that have been created to compete with American Express that are really charge cards. So there's no preset limit with a charge card. And so they don't report, again, the credit limit. Now, what happens typically is, let's say you put what, Tess, or I put $1,000 on my charge card.
Mm-hmm.
That might be treated as my credit limit. That's sort of a fairly common practice.
Essentially, isn't what happens that then your credit score looks like you are utilizing maybe 100% of your outstanding credit, and so it's going to ding your credit score, right? Now, is there anything that you can do about that? Can you call the credit card company and say, can you please report my credit limit?
You're absolutely right. It's this thing called utilization ratio. You probably heard that term, you know, thrown around. So let's just give an example. So let's say I have a $5,000 credit limit, and I typically carry $4,000. Now, I'm not going to have a very good credit score, right? Because, you know, carrying a fair amount of debt there compared to my credit limit next to somebody with a $5,000 credit limit, and they typically are carrying, what, $250.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple things you can do. One, with the creation of a lot of these bank charge cards, call up the bank and say, hey, I don't like this charge card because you don't report my credit limit. So how about giving me a card that has a credit limit that you do report on? And typically within their portfolio of credit cards, they'll have one for you.
Okay. Well, Chris, up next, we have Leora in Felton, California, and her family is facing some pretty tough financial decisions. What's the situation, Leora?
Well, my husband needs a oral surgery, which costs about $7,000, and we don't have dental insurance. And we also have about $6,000 in credit card debt or so, or more like $7,000. And so we're just looking at ways to pay for that. And, you know, for years I've been putting aside $100 per paycheck into a fund for my kids' college education,
mm-hmm.
which has sort of been our sacred don't touch that money no matter what. But I've been watching that dwindle as the stock market crashes. And so I'm more willing to look at that now because it just seems like why let that waste away when I could use it to pay off debt.
Right. Chris, we are getting this question over and over in all kinds of iterations where folks are watching their retirement accounts, their kids' college accounts, as Leora said, dwindle away. And they're wondering if it would just be better to use that money elsewhere. What do you think?
All right. As a general rule, I'm going to say no.
Really?
You're going to want to leave the money there. The reasons why it's a general piece of advice is that when you withdraw the money, you pay a 10% penalty. So that just is gone.
Right.
And then you pay income taxes. So the question is, how much will you really have when you withdraw? It's going to be a very expensive source of money. So I assume that you've done this, but if you haven't, I mean, I would stop funding it.
You would stop putting money into the kids' account?
Absolutely. I would completely stop funding it. I mean, look, you got some money. It's wonderful. They'll use it when they go to college. I think that's great. How old are your kids?
They're 5 and 8.
You have plenty of time. You've actually done the hard part and the really smart part, that if you fund something on the early side and then stop funding it, it's still going to grow very, very nicely, as opposed to, say, you started when they were 14 or 15.
Right.
Now here's the other layer that comes in. I was talking to John Bogle. He's the founder of Vanguard and just plain smart.
Well, we've had him on the show several times, and the guy knows his stuff.
He knows his stuff. So he says, look, the other question is, how close are you to the edge? The closer you are to the financial edge, the more you're going to have to do things that may not be smart from an investment point of view. What I've just told you is what's smart from an investment point of view. If this is really going to put you in a financial bind and you have this big payment coming in here, okay, then you may have to do the not smart thing from an investment point of view, but it's the right thing to do to keep your family from getting itself into debt trouble. There's a penalty to pay for that. There's a price to pay for that. But I'm not going to criticize you for doing that if it's going to make your overall household more financially secure going forward.
Okay. Thank you so much for your help. I think that gives me something to work with.
You bet. Thanks for the call. All right. If you have a question for us, just give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or write us an email. You can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. Lots of people troll the internet to comparison shop and bargain hunt. Others just call mom.
What's the matter with buying a warranty?
Oh, Daniel, you don't need a warranty for those things. Read Consumer Reports.
Mother the Market Maven is coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. So by now, you've probably heard that Black Friday was way more successful than most folks expected. And spending jumped 15% this Cyber Monday as people hit the internets for holiday deals. I like a bargain like anyone else, especially these days when you want your dollar to go as far as possible. I won't set foot inside Bed Bath & Beyond without one of those ubiquitous 20% off coupons in hand. I mean, not using them is like giving money away. But in the wide world of bargain hunting, I'm a pipsqueak, especially compared to what reporter Daniel Estrin grew up with.
Meet my mom.
You turn off that tape, you're wasting the batteries.
That's all right. When I was back home this summer, I needed to stock up on some batteries for my digital recorder, and my mom jumped at the chance to take me shopping. She's not a shopaholic, but she does consider herself an expert on the price of things.
Batteries can be very expensive. You gotta know what the 9 volts are running. You gotta know what the C's are running, the double A's, but don't wanna overpay.
She's gotta find the best deal on the market. But even more than that, she's gotta tell you about it.
Now here's the tip of the day. I've learned there's a coupon on the paper, so...
That's the way it's been since I was a kid. The entire ride to the store, Mom would talk about rebates for contact lens solution, hitting credit card fees, and everything you ever wanted to know about socks. My sisters and I still joke about her obsession.
I've heard that. Mom's crazy. Mom's really nuts.
Well, my whole attitude about Mom changed this summer when I picked up The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. If you haven't read it, The Tipping Point is a book that explains how people with certain social skills contribute to social trends. Anyway, when I got to page 60, it hit me. Gladwell introduces the prototype of what economists call the market maven. It's also known as the price vigilante. Here are some lines from the book. A maven is a person who has information on a lot of different products or prices or places.
Okay, I'm at Costco. They've got this great buy. They have an 8-gig thumb drive with $10 coupon.
This is the person who connects people to the marketplace.
A hell of a deal. You know anybody that needs one?
They distribute coupons.
I could tell you about some wonderful rebates out there.
They like to be helpers in the marketplace.
Anyway, I'll help you with that.
Bingo. My mom's not crazy. She's a sociological phenomenon studied by economists. And once I started thinking about it that way, her peculiar behaviors started to make more sense. Like with gas prices.
Shell, Phillips, Mobil, they're all $3.86 a gallon. Sam's at $3.81. The bottom of the hill is $3.89. That's BP. Once the bottom of the hill goes up, you can bet your bottom dollar that Olive Street Road's going to go up. So you just have to know the territory.
Like any good market maven, Mom wrote all of that up in an email to her friend Sue, who then printed it out and propped it up on the car dashboard for reference. Here's Sue.
Well, if we say Estrin Economics in our household, everybody knows what that means. She has told us about airline tickets, home insurance, how to buy college textbooks online. Jean knows.
About a year ago, without consulting my mother, I bought a USB memory stick and got an extended warranty for $15 more. I thought it was a good deal. My mom didn't.
And then you bought an extended warranty. And I thought, oh, my God, have I failed. Failed as a mother. You didn't pick up the phone to ask.
What's the matter with buying a warranty?
Oh, Daniel, you don't need a warranty for those things. Read Consumer Reports.
The Tipping Point, page 65. Quote, mavens are the kinds of people who are avid readers of Consumer Reports.
Well, you know, you don't have to make me look like such a maven.
I've come to realize that I, for one, am not a market maven. And not everyone is. But you should always have one at your disposal so you don't get bamboozled on your next purchase.
Lesson over for the day?
Oh, no, there's so much more to learn.
From St. Louis, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
All right, we're back with more Getting Personal, and with me once again is our own Chris Farrell. And Chris, we've got on the line Joanne Germoux. She's from Alexandria, Virginia, and had a bit of trouble with a check she wrote to a charity. Hi, Joanne, what happened?
Hi, Chris and Tess. Well, what happened was I wrote a check to one of the charities that I've supported for a very long time, making sure that I made my December 31st cutoff, and lo and behold, the charity resubmitted my check, they say, through an error, and my bank honored it.
Uh-oh. So it was withdrawn twice?
Yeah. And it was, you know, for hundreds of dollars. And my bank didn't in any way flag it. They just went ahead and honored it.
Did you talk to the bank?
I did talk to the bank, and their initial reaction was to send me to the charity and find out what happened.
And what did the charity say?
Well, the charity admitted that they'd made a mistake. They offered to send me the money back, which never happened. At some point, the bank actually gave me a credit back. I got something in the mail showing that they'd credited it back. But I just assumed I hand the charity a piece of paper. They turn in the piece of paper, and it disappears. They're not able to submit it again. And even if they did, I thought the bank would say, oops, this number's already been taken. We've already honored this check.
You would hope so. Chris, how does this happen?
Well, the big fault here is actually the charity in resubmitting the check. The lesson that I take from this is you still have to do the old-fashioned check the paperwork.
So is this something where she shouldn't worry about needing to go to a different bank? This could have happened pretty much anywhere?
This could happen in any bank. By the way, I do think that it is very important, as we have a lot of bank mergers, we have a lot of bank rescues, we have a lot of strain on the financial system, that the old-fashioned basics of checking your checking account, checking what is going through, becomes more important. It's not great that it's up to us to check this stuff, but I think it is more important at this time of financial strain to do that than under normal circumstances.
Sounds like Chris is saying maybe forgive and in this kind of strange time in the banking world, check up a little more often than we usually do.
I think I'm going to have to.
All right. Well, good luck to you, and I'm glad it all worked out.
Thank you so much.
Chris, let's go right to an email. We've got a lot of questions coming in about mortgage issues. First, Stephanie in Pompano Beach, Florida. Her interest rate went down recently on her mortgage, and she's debating whether to refinance to have a little extra money every month. We do get this question quite often, you know, from folks wondering if we can tell them if rates are going down or rates are going up. No one can tell you that.
Wrong way to think about it. Here's the question. If rates went up, how bad a situation would you be in? You can't get greedy. If there's an opportunity for you to stabilize your financial situation, the question is, am I going to be better off? Secondly, what are the closing costs? What is it going to cost you? And remember, whenever you refinance, one of the most important questions to ask yourself, how long am I going to be in this home? Typically, if you're not going to be at home for, 4 to 5 years? It probably doesn't pay the refinance unless that rise in interest rates, which may emerge, it may not emerge. I don't know. But if you are vulnerable to that, then you should refinance if you can.
All right. Well, here's another related question, another refinancing dilemma from Jessica in Sacramento, California. She's got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage on a house that is more than halfway paid off. Good for her. She owes a little less than $200,000 at 6.5%. As we know, rates right now are quite a bit lower than that. So she's, again, asking about refinancing. Is this time for her to shop for a better deal? I don't know. I mean, when you've got a 30-year fixed in this environment, even at 6.5%, should she refinance?
Probably not. You know, she might want to look at it. I mean, rates had dropped down as low as 5.5%, but they're bouncing around. It depends on what is your credit score. That's going to have big implications. Do you get the best credit rate? She has what is important, which she has a lot of equity in her home. So that's really going to help out. But the other thing is it's more than half paid off. So in her situation, what might be better than a refinancing is to accelerate her payments. For example, we've talked about tests in the past. Rather than making 12 payments a year, once a month, you turn a year into 13 months and you make 13 payments. And that's a nice way to accelerate down payment of that mortgage without getting yourself strapped and putting all your money into the mortgage itself. But it's a good way to pay it off more quickly. So if she wants to look into it, that's fine. But unless there's some nice cost savings that she's going to see to her bottom line, I don't see any reason why she would do it. And in fact, I'd be looking a little more closely at, should I try the 13-month a year payment plan? That might not be a bad way to get rid of this mortgage more quickly.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions on this week's show. But you can call us anytime. We're at 877-275-6669, 877-ASK-MONEY. And you can also write us an email. The Getting Personal link is at marketplace.org. And Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks, Seth.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The cool fountain in front of the Bellagio Hotel in Vegas, the one Ocean's 11 stand in front of at the end of that movie. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we'll meet someone who spends her days choreographing water.
My name is Bonnie Thompson. I work with Wet Design. I am a designer that focuses on choreographing water fountains to music. We build these really big and complicated equipment rooms that control a whole lake of water that we make dance. Water can squirt and spray and twirl and bubble and do all kinds of things. My job is to really stretch its limits. Well, the fountains that we design are usually much more involved than a static backyard fountain, and they're usually a whole lot bigger. Well, I use a computer first to program and create the visual movements that I want to see. Once that's all done, I will bring it to the fountain and actually watch it there. When I'm working on the computer, I have this really pretty graphic representation of what I'm going to get in the water. But when I get out to the site, you know, there's water flying everywhere. It's, you know, it's very few times actually what I had envisioned. A wet water feature is going to range anywhere, usually from about a million and up. And up, I mean, we can have a whole lot of fun with these, and they can get pretty expensive. A designer at WET can be expected to make, from a starting salary, anywhere from $50,000 to up to around $100,000 a year. Introducing what I do to somebody I've never met before, or even people that I know really well, that just aren't really aware of what I do, is a really awkward experience in some ways. You know, you can kind of shut down a conversation with, I'm an accountant, but people tend to have a lot of questions when given the answer of, I'm a water choreographer. What is a water choreographer? For starters. Well, I don't really like to call them fountains because it kind of demeans what they are and what they do. You know, at night we light them up and they become like these jewels, you know, in parks or in malls, and they make people happy.
If you'd like to know more about Bonnie Thompson and her creations, check out our website, marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Devin Brown. Earlier in the show, we reviewed how some credit card companies are making it harder for some to pay off their bills. But when and why did we become a nation so tied to credit? Stuart Vyse might have an answer. He's the author of the book Going Broke: Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. And Stuart, we seem to be inordinately comfortable with the idea of being in debt. You know, just pull it up, put it on plastic, right?
We do purchase now anything on credit. It used to be the case that borrowing money was good for only certain kinds of activities, for an asset, for a home. Now we're told that the experience of a baseball game or anything is priceless. And, of course, we do have a commercial economy. Unfortunately, we can't sustain that forever.
Indebtedness really doesn't generate much compassion, does it? I mean, is there really a difference between the person who makes $100,000 and simply doesn't save and then has a massive health crisis that health insurance won't cover, and so they end up in bankruptcy, and the person who on the other end of the spectrum is making $20,000 and simply goes into bankruptcy because they can't afford daily expenses? Should we think about those two things differently?
Yes, I think we should. The person who has more resources, has a big income, obviously should be able to avoid bankruptcy. For the most part, they do. People who have higher incomes don't end up in bankruptcy court very often. But the problem is that we have many people who are, on the lower half of the income curve, very much saddled with debt. And let's remember that on the other side of that equation, a lot of money is being made. You know, the credit card divisions of most banks are their most profitable part of banking. And so they're making a lot of money off of these people who are, unfortunately, living a very anxious life day to day, trying to figure out which bills to pay this month and which not.
You had your own experience with debt. How bad was it, and how did you manage to get out?
I acquired about $12,000 in credit card debt over a period of years. My kids were young. I was starting out with my family, and I went through a divorce and other things. But I was lucky in the sale of a home, and this is how many people have gotten by in the past. I was able to sell a home and get out of debt, and I've remained out of debt since then. My story shows, I think, how, first of all, common it is to be in debt with large sums of money that you think you're not going to be able to pay off. So I'm lucky. I have a very good income. I'm a college professor who's tenured. I'm not going to lose my job. But not everyone has that advantage, and that's an important advantage in this world of debt.
The final chapter of your book is titled How Not to Go Broke. Can you give us the lowdown?
Sure. Most importantly, save. And the thing to do is to set up a savings plan that is automatic, that is taken out of your pay, hopefully before you ever even see it. The other thing I would recommend that people should think about in today's world is ask yourself, just as you're about to make a purchase, do I need to do this right this minute? We overvalue things we can have right now. And actually, the big things in the future, like a retirement and a comfortable life in your dotage, those are worth a lot more than that thing that you're looking at right now.
Stuart Vise is the author of Going Broke, Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. Stuart, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we take a closer look at the B word.
Bankruptcy is not the mark of Cain. It's not the scarlet letter. Nobody puts a B on your forehead and says, ooh, there goes the bankrupt person.
Marketplace Money is produced by Jim Wallace, Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.